Hey, what's up? I'm Gautam Sharma, and you're listening to the Access Cyber Podcast. On the show today, my guest, Dr. Nasir Memon from NYU. Nasir is an academic, an educator, a founder, researcher, and a true pioneer in the cybersecurity education community. Today, you're going to have the opportunity to listen to his thoughts on a number of different topics. Here we go.
Dr. Nasir Memon, welcome to the show. Very excited to have you.
No, thank you. Thank you, Gautam. Thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Of course. When I think of you, I think of one of the pioneers sort of in cybersecurity education. And you're at NYU now. You wear a number of different hats. What are you doing there?
Oh, so currently I have the title of a vice dean at NYU. Most of my time essentially goes in developing new innovative programs across the whole school, not just in cybersecurity, but across all the departments. Our thinking is that higher education is going through some disruption, especially accelerated in the last 1 year or so because of the COVID situation. But before that itself, I was given the charge of leading the innovation, right? Like getting NYU there in the front of all these changes that might be happening. We don't know exactly where things will go, right? But we want to be at the table wherever things go. Of course, before that, most people know me for having started the cybersecurity program at NYU a long time ago, right? Almost 20 years ago. As a faculty member who does a lot of research. And then I sort of, for some time, I was the director of the cybersecurity center that I started, co-founded along with my colleagues at NYU. First in the engineering school, then expanded it to the other schools as well at NYU. Also expanded the cybersecurity center, started one in NYU's Abu Dhabi campus. Also, people know me as the founder of Seesaw, one of the largest student-run cybersecurity events in the world, very famous Osiris Lab that runs Seesaw. And then more recently, I started a new version of a Master's in Cybersecurity program, which I, by the way, started a dozen years ago, but 3 years back, we started an affordable, scalable cyber fellows program along with a very innovative bridge program. So that's another hat that I wear now. That's one of my big responsibilities as the program is ramping up. I'm the one responsible for that entire program. And I'm responsible for all the online programs at NYU Tandon as well. So yeah, quite a few hats I'm wearing right now.
You said 20 years ago. What did all of this in the cybersecurity world, I think, you know, we hear like it's a buzzword and all these things, right?
Right.
What did it look like 20 years ago?
Yeah, it was interesting. So let's go back a bit more than 20 years ago, right? 25, 30 years ago, maybe 25 years ago. I'm maybe giving up my age by saying these numbers. But I was a master's student and I did my thesis in cryptography. Right. And so I had fun doing it. And then I started looking at whether data compression techniques could be used for cryptography, in the sense you kind of kill two birds with one stone, like you compress it and it's encrypted as well because there's some secret involved in the compression algorithm. And voila, you have a compression encryption scheme. Right. So. Never could do it. I mean, you can always come up with ad hoc schemes, but proving security in a rigorous way is always very difficult in cryptography. I ended up doing my thesis in compression, right? And I wandered around the Midwest for a few years and found my way into New York City, I guess, where I probably belonged, and started teaching at what was then Polytechnic University, right? And Brooklyn Polytechnic. And so there, since I'd done work in cryptography, they asked me if I would teach a course in security, which was kind of in the books. And I looked at it. Yeah, a lot of it was cryptography. And I knew that well, I could teach it. So there was a lot of crypto stuff going on. But then a lot of the systems, hands-on things were creeping into. There were things more like towards like multilateral security and the Bell-LaPadula model and very theoretical sort of reasoning about security, driven more from the DoD-like environments. But I think that was about 1998, I believe, where sort of practical issues were popping up, right? Viruses had started happening and things of that sort. We were being interconnected and networks and the Morris worm had happened. And suddenly security was, at least not from the research, but at least from the student point of view, they were also looking at, man, network security, computer security, and things of that sort, software security. So those components sort of started coming in. And they were most of the security courses then were teaching mostly cryptography, right? And there were very few labs, if any, in cybersecurity, right? And one thing I kind of quickly saw that you cannot teach security by talking about it. You need to engage with it. There's like a hands-on component to it. There's an adversary involved, right? There is a bad guy out there, right? And you need to then engage in exercises that where you anticipate the bad guy or catch the bad guy and things of that sort. And we do this in say, when we're training soldiers or in athletics, when we're training athletes, right, to play soccer or something of that sort, we play against each other for practice. And I thought some mechanism like that is needed in security too, because there is an adversary involved. So I started a lab, and I think at the undergraduate level, perhaps it was one of the first few labs in the country. I got funding from National Science Foundation to start a lab, and that sort of started my whole journey in cybersecurity, right? I actually, when I joined Poly, they'd hired me for my data compression chops. I had just made some interesting contributions to the JPEG standard, and I was getting my name recognized in the data compression, at least the practical aspects of it, that community. And I never imagined I would be doing security like in at that time, right? But somehow simply wandered into it. But it was dominated by cryptography and by theoretical modeling and things of that sort. And I'm not saying either of those two things are wrong. They both are needed, right? But that was what dominated the conversation then in a security class, at least. I'm seeing more and more security programs and courses running under business schools because, as they say, security is also a process, right? It's not simply, security is not a technology. You can't buy a magical box that'll protect your network. You need technology, you need people, you need processes. And that kind of brings in all the sort of managerial tasks along with it, and compliance and regulations and assessment and all that. Cryptographers have gone in crazy esoteric world. I mean, they do phenomenal things. Don't misunderstand me. I tell people that if I was smarter, I would probably become a cryptographer. I did not. So they do stuff that is way out there in the future, potentially. And they do occasionally come up with very interesting things that are applied immediately. At NYU, we are fortunate enough to have two good computer science departments, one in the engineering school, where all the security stuff is, and in the College of Arts and Science, in the Courant Institute of Mathematical Science, right? That's more of a mathematical institute within which that CS department sits. And they just do cryptography. They barely do any security, no?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, they do phenomenal cryptography. They have some of the best cryptographers in the world, but they don't even teach a security course.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. So this is a good segue to my next question. As I'm thinking, mm-hmm. you mentioned that two things you mentioned that I'm touching on. Cybersecurity is a process. I love that. How do you define cybersecurity from an academic perspective?
It's so nebulous, right? You can define it as the art and science of securing information systems, but that doesn't really say much. We talk about security of a system being defined by the policies. Without a policy, there's no such thing as security, right? After all, security is violation of policy. What is allowed and what is not allowed? And security then is a collection of mechanisms that are put in place in order to enforce the policies of a system. So that's perhaps one way of putting it. Sharpens it a little bit more, but not enough, perhaps. I mean, when I teach a class, I haven't taught for a few years now, but when I teach a class in security, I do start with the definitions and I give about six of them, sort of pointing out that there's so many different ways of looking at it that people have adopted. But this is perhaps the broadest one, like study of the mechanisms, how to develop mechanisms that enforce security policies of a system, right?
From an academic perspective, what is, I don't like the word goal of security, but the students who go through these programs, where can they see themselves?
Right. So I think what we try to do is, of course, we give them a broad sort of grounding in all the technologies involved, right? Going from cryptography to network security protocols writing secure applications and writing secure code to penetration testing and then forensics and biometrics and writing exploits and things of that sort. Mm-hmm. But I think what we probably, at least at the undergraduate level, what we are trying to do really is making them understand, getting a security mindset. Right. So these are undergrads. They're just beginning the career as an engineer or as a scientist, and we're giving them the basic grounding. Right. And when it comes to security, one of the components of that basic grounding is this, what I call the security mindset, how to think like a security engineer. So like they jokingly say in the security community that when you are building a robust and reliable system, right? You're designing against God. That you're designing against accidents. What if a earthquake happens and my building shouldn't fall down, right? And things of that sort. So you're designing against accidents and even human errors sometimes, but errors. But when you're designing secure systems, you're designing against the devil. Right, because there is an adversary out there who will understand, who will get a deep understanding of your system and will find the exact spot, right, which brings the system down, the exact spot which you did not anticipate when you were developing it, right? So that means that when we're developing secure systems, when you're developing secure systems, we have to be thinking about the adversary, right? Anticipating, understanding the threat model, right? And thinking of terms in what the adversary could do, where, and what mechanisms should be placed in order to detect it, prevent it, mitigate it, whatever that may be called for. And in hindsight, it's kind of easy to do, right? So for example, the heinous act that happened in 9/11, right? Where the perpetrators got in through the cockpit door and took control of the airplane. Now, why were the perpetrators allowed to get into the cockpit, right? Because there's a flimsy door there, right? And now there's a simple basic security principle that any sort of entities in the system should only have access to any object, right? Only if they're required to, principle of least privilege, right? Mm-hmm. And now we put a barrier out there and we kind of sort of have a reinforced cockpit door. They can't kick it down. And every time the pilot comes out, the steward like blocks the passageway and things of that sort, right? So we have mechanisms in place that make sure that a passenger cannot go into the cockpit, right? The fix is easy, right? There's no high tech. It's a simple fix, right? In hindsight, it's easy, but we didn't think about it when we are designing all the operational sort of procedures of what is allowed and what's not allowed on the airplane, right? We kind of didn't think about that. And that's what makes sort of security sort of difficult. And of course, now they did all that. They barricaded the doors. It could be locked from inside. And then some crazy pilot in Germany decided to run the plane into a mountain, right, and kill everybody and commit suicide. Now what do you do? Now you need an open door, right? You not need the ability for passengers to maybe ask someone to go in, open the door and intervene. But no, your security system now prevents that. So solutions also are not always obvious, and there's always a sort of a trade-off that you make. And I think the security engineers have to understand systems. And what we try to get across to our students is that you have to understand what the risks are, what the bad person will be able to do, right? And then find the right trade-off, right? Right, that gives you the benefits of the technology, right? We can make everything secure and make it totally unusable. So, but at the same time, has enough security mechanisms in place, right, that sort of increases the cost of the adversary to a point where it's not really practical for an adversary to do something, right? Or it's the probability goes down. So thinking like a security engineer, having the security mindset, is what we aspire to teach, Gautam. And we do that by practice, right? By giving them projects, by making sure that they are testing each other's codes, they're finding vulnerabilities in each other's codes, they're discussing problems, security problems in each other's solutions and things of that sort. By having events like Seesaw, where they compete in a competition, a challenge and things of that sort. And hopefully that grows those muscles where they start thinking like a security engineer. So that's when you're just talking about security, right? And then when you're talking about a general computer scientist or electrical engineer, computer engineer, I think we have that basic responsibility that we should be teaching them about security, some basis that we should be making them aware that there are security issues with everything that you do. Even to a mechanical engineer, even to civil engineer, everybody should learn about security, just like they learn about reliability, right? As an engineer, they should learn about security as well. I've been hearing this for 20 years, unfortunately, almost 20 years. At least 15 years, and I don't see really anybody doing a very good job with this, including us, right? So that's the other thing we should be doing at the undergraduate level. Mm-hmm. At the graduate level, a lot of our graduate students are working professionals, right? And they are in operational roles, right, that sometimes quite often involve security. And they want more sort of knowledge about technology, right, as to what is possible and what are the new things coming up and what kind of new technologies are there, what are the strengths, what are the weaknesses and things of that sort. So sometimes they desire more of that knowledge for career advancement. And of course, this hands-on experiences always, I believe, are required for them as well. But they are in environments which we cannot replicate that well in academia, right? I mean, we have toy networks compared to what somebody working in a multinational bank or something like that, right, would be working in. So there, I think they're more concerned about the new, latest evolving technologies, what the trends are and things of that sort.
A couple things. I was just jotting down notes as you're talking. What is the incentive for someone to go and pursue a master's degree versus, or let's say, in addition to some certifications?
That's a great question. We have recently launched a very unique master's program at NYU in cybersecurity called the Cyber Fellows, right? It's the same master's program we've had for 15 years, but the Cyber Fellows is designed for working professionals, and it's affordable. We give them 75% scholarships, and it's online and flexible and all that stuff. And most of the students, they have 5 to 10 years experience, and they're from some of the largest companies, right? Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, US Bank, TIA, Target, etc. And when they're first thinking about joining, they talk to me and I basically address the same question, right? Say, you're a busy person, you have a job and you have a family, you have a life, and doing a master's program is not easy. Graduate school is hard. Why should you do this? Why don't you simply go to Miami for a week and get training by vendor X or vendor Y on this tool or that tool? And that's useful. I'm not saying that's useless. And that's useful to you because it gives you very concrete, specific knowledge, and you come back from the training and you're now better at that role that you're doing immediately almost. So why not just do that and why do a master's? I mean, that's a legitimate question. My argument is that training teaches you about a specific tool or a specific framework, but in order to be a member of the workforce today on a trajectory that will take you forward in the future, right, to better and better career outcomes, you need a foundation as a scientist or an engineer that you will be able to build upon. Learning will not end with the acquisition of a master's degree, with the acquisition of a credential. Learning definitely doesn't end with the training, because those trainings are very short-lived, right? They tell you about things that are current today. 2 years later, they're gone, maybe some of them. But same thing for master's, right? So training, master's, the credentials doesn't mean that your education has ended. Mm-hmm. Learning is lifelong, especially in technology, and even more so in cybersecurity, where new technologies keep coming up and you need to keep advancing your knowledge. You need to keep learning. And in order to do that, you need to build the foundation of being a scientist or an engineer, right? Thinking like a scientist, learning the language of science, learning how to analyze things, learning how to abstract problems, learning the basic tools, solutions like machine learning or data science and cryptography and learning the basic sort of concepts that you can then continue to build upon. And that, I think, that's the foundation of that house that you're building, right? That is needed. And the deeper the foundation is, the stronger the foundation is, the taller the mansion you can build on top of that, right? And that mansion is your career. So I think master's degrees, I agree, are bulky. Sometimes they are a bit divorced from practicality. We try to avoid that by partnering heavily with industry in our master's program. We have industry partners who help us shape the curriculum, who give us feedback, who mentor the students, who teach. So we realize that the right master's degree has to be designed in partnership with academia and industry. It's not done by one of them alone, but that foundation of learning is needed, and that's what the master's credential gives you. There needs to be more innovation there. It needs to be somehow chopped up and made more flexible, flexibility is what working professionals need, and it needs to be made more affordable and things of that sort. I mean, why should a master's program cost $60,000? I don't know. So I think there's still a lot of room for improvement on how we do our master's programs. I believe at NYU, we have taken some steps in the right direction, but there's still a lot of room. But I believe that they're still essential today to build that foundation. They build a foundation for lifelong learning. Lifelong learning is more than simply taking certificates all the time. I mean, you would need to come to academia to get the deeper foundational knowledge.
That being said, is there a certification that you think has some weight in the industry today?
Some of the certifications are simply passing an exam. What does that mean? Right? You memorized a book, you passed an exam. No, right? I mean, a master's program, we make them write code and find vulnerabilities. We make them do a project. We make them hack each other's code. We make them go out and do research and write papers and things of that sort. A lot of these are simply short-term knowledge, but they seem to be essential in the sense that industry seems to want them. I've known like Phil Venables, who is one of the most respected CISOs in the country. He used to be the CISO of Goldman Sachs. He used to tell me that he didn't care about certifications. He used to not even look at any certification that they had, right? That's not important to him. What was important was whether they understood what was going on, right? Whether they had the scientific knowledge or whatever. He wanted them to learn the hard science. He sent about 30 people to our program, 30 of his team members to our program in the Masters in Cybersecurity. And so there are some CISOs who don't pay attention to certifications. And the many certifications who give interesting hands-on experiences that are valid, they quickly get them into a job potentially, right? Because the CISO might say, okay, they know about cryptography and they know this algorithm, they know how routing works and they know the SSL protocol works, but what do I care? I want them to push these buttons and do their role. So let me teach them how to push these buttons. But that's easy. That can be done. I'm not saying they're not needed. So all those training components are needed. But don't expect academia to do that for you, right? So actually in Cyber Fellows, what we did, so an interesting compromise I found, right, between this foundational learning and role-related learning. When the industry folks say that, hey, you know, we want our folks to know Splunk or something like that, right? And I say, I cannot tell my professor to use Splunk in the classroom. The professor decides what they want and what is the best thing to use to convey the concepts. But you know what? Let's create a system where you teach them and you give them a badge. So Splunk actually now teaches our students Splunk fundamentals for free. We give them a badge, NYU Splunk badge. And the students now get practical knowledge which could be applicable in their job, which we didn't give them in the classroom. But there are many more of these companies, right? There are a dozen companies now, Qualys and Zscaler and even the city cyber and New York City Cyber Command. They come and do a two-day red team, blue team exercise with our students, with our Cyber Fellow students, right? And the students get a really practical experience. They get on a cyber range, they get their hands onto a practical like environment in which they have to find out the bad guys who are already inside, right? They have to find them and remove them. So very useful exercise. We can't do that in academia that well, but they can do that. And we say, okay, so you teach them what you think is important. We teach them what we think is important. But the students come out ahead as winners because they get the foundational knowledge we give them and they get the practical knowledge that industry gives them. And they come out of it. They have some sort of a combination of the two. It's a very new concept. We've just been doing it for 1.5 years now, 2 years. And we're seeing that the students really love it and we are growing it more and more. And we'll see where that takes, right? But that's some kind of something like that is needed.
It almost sounds like what you're saying is if you sort of have a good understanding of the fundamentals, the tools are, you know, are easier to grasp.
Yes. And okay. Without knowledge of fundamentals, you'll never grasp you'll maybe learn a tool X, but you'll be a tool monkey, right? Jumping from tool to another. You will never solve problems. You'll be simply pushing buttons. So we make them do algorithms in our master's program. And students complain, right? Saying, why do we need algorithms? And I say, right. It's a way of thinking. It's a way of thinking that you're learning. And it'll benefit you. You're not using in your job directly, explicitly, but implicitly. It has matured you as a thinker. And that's what will help. So that's where we are trying to head, let's see how things shake out, kind of.
A lot of times when I speak to people, either on the show or elsewhere about these topics, the consensus seems to be a solid foundation in computer science will set you up for a career in cybersecurity. So my question to you is, if there's a school, for example, let's say, and they have a computer science program that's not security heavy, what are, let's say, 4 courses that you would add to that, or 4 topics you would add to that curriculum to now prepare students for a security career?
Okay, yeah. So I think the first course would simply be a introduction, right? A broad survey on security and privacy, which kind of starts getting the security mindset into their thinking, right? Threat modeling and attack trees and attack frameworks and adversary and things of that sort, showing them how things can go wrong and what fixes there are, engaging them break and fix like exercise, right? In person, like in, they build an exercise which they break and then they fix, right? So getting them this firsthand kind of experience of security, which involves both offense and defense, right? And the foundational knowledge, right? So thinking about threats and attacks and things of that sort. So we call it, you could call it introduction to security, and probably everybody has something like that. You can sprinkle in some cryptography as a mechanism, but don't go into the mathematics of it and things of that sort, right? A second course you would want to teach them is network security, right? Because a lot of the time, because you also need to protect data in transit, right? It's not simply protecting data at rest, are protecting a system, right? But protecting data in transit, and also protecting a complex. It's not simply protecting a host. The first course, many of the examples are simply host-based, right? or device-based, right? But the second course, you start looking at a system, a network, right, where there's data flowing around. You need to protect them in transit. You need to protect what's coming in. You need to watch what's going out. You need to be watching the network, intrusion detection, all penetration testing, all those things. So they should be familiar with that, right? Then the third course perhaps could dig down a bit more in application security, how to build secure applications, right? Because that's where a lot of the problems come in, right? How to build secure applications. So application security, and that's from scratch, right? Into standalone applications, to server versions and cloud versions and mobile versions and things like that, right? And finding vulnerabilities in applications. So, of course, you could call it application security, you could call it secure software engineering or software security or whatever that may be, but it's sort of spanning standalone software, web-facing software, server-side, cloud security, right? Deployed in the cloud and things of that sort. So these three courses could be sort of foundational. After that, I think the fourth one, I would kind of, the many choices. You could go a deep dive into cryptography, do a mathematical treatment of cryptography, where you do actually proofs and figure out mathematically why these things are secure. What does it mean for a system to be secure, right? And in a mathematical fashion. Of course, when they work, they don't do that, but at least they will understand what is behind many of the cryptographic mechanisms that they're using, right? Why are they secure? And if they don't use cryptography properly, then they'll make mistakes and attackers will find their way in, right? So knowing the foundations could be important. That could be one approach you could take. A second approach you could take is like, okay, security management. What role does security play in an enterprise? What are the basic components and how is it secure, right? Audits and identity management and stuff like that. Sort of a security management course from an enterprise point of view. Or it could be a usable security course, right? It's talking about the human aspects of it. That fourth course could be an elective that you could give, but the first three course, right? The introduction, the software and network, these three things perhaps are needed. So that's what we do in our program. Those first three I mentioned are required. The fourth one we require is the cryptography course. The others we offer as electives then. So we have security management courses and things like that as electives.
Yeah, that's a solid lineup. I think I agree with most of those choices. That's a good list. The elective piece is important, particularly because there's all these different paths we can go down in security, right? Sure, the pen testers are depicted as like, you know, just the what security is all about a lot of times. Movies have caught on to and they've stuck with it. A bunch of different roles in security that, depending on how technically deep you want to get into it, there's and how, you know, how much on the business side you want to be. And I mean, there's a healthy mix of all of those things. Right. This has been a lot of fun. Where can folks go to connect with you and learn more about the program at NYU?
I guess they could email me at memon, M-E-M-O-N, at nyu.edu. And I can point them. Otherwise, just Google NYU Cybersecurity or NYU Cyber Fellows is our main cybersecurity program. But we have many scholarship opportunities. We have lots of research opportunities and many other things going on, ranging all the way from high school all the way to PhD. So or the NYU Center for Cybersecurity actually could be a place to go where everything probably gets pointed to from there.
Fantastic. Yeah. We'll link to all of those. And Nasir, this was fantastic. Thank you for taking the time. A lot of fun.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this conversation, there's plenty of more great content available on our website at accesscyber.org. That's accesscyber.org. Thanks for listening, and as always, happy hacking.